Test, test. This is David Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center of the Edison Institute. And today we're talking with Mr. Henry de Segur Lauve, L-A-U-V-E. And Mr. Lauve is a retired General Motors designer. Who was with General Motors for many years and is well known in design circles and well respected by his peers and former associates. We are asking Mr. Lauve today to give us his career history and to give us along the way glimpses of his contacts with people. With his former contemporaries in the General Motors design field. We feel that Mr. Lauve's career is such that he will be able to illuminate much of General Motors design history from the 30s to the 60s and beyond.
My name is Henry de Segur Lauve. It's spelled D-E-S-E-G-U-R-L-A-U-V-E. I was born in New Jersey, and I'm a descendant of a French family who settled in New Orleans and helped develop New Orleans. The de Segurs came over in the 1700s and married into the Lauve family. We went to Europe, my family and I, and I went to school in the north of France at first, and then to the Collège Champité in Switzerland. That's C-H-A-M-P-I-T-T-E-T. And thereafter to a design school in Vienna, called the Kunstgewerbeschule, which, should I spell that too?
Well, if you have it, yes.
K-U-N-S-T-G-E-W-E-R-B-E-S-C-H-U-L-E. It's a design school which specializes in various forms of design, including art and architecture. I went to the University of Paris, from which I graduated, and then I studied portrait painting at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. The Rijksmuseum is spelled R-I-J-K-S. I first became interested in automotive drawings. Actually, I used to draw cars in the back of my textbooks and so forth. I was always interested in cars and airplanes. But my roommate in Champité was a Count de Vibre who had a Bugatti.
Vibre, too.
Count de Vibre is V-I-B-R-A-Y-E.
He had a Bugatti, a large one?
He had a two-passenger sport Bugatti.
Mm-hmm.
And another friend had an Amilcar, which is a French small car, also a sport car. A-M-I-L-C-A-R.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me to visit him in Paris, which I did, and we used to ride around Paris in the Bugatti, which mm-hmm. was quite a sensation in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Thereafter, I worked in Paris as a designer. As a matter of fact, I did fashion design in Paris, but I also designed several custom bodies for bodybuilders in those days who the car manufacturers built the chassis and engines and so forth, and the bodybuilders did custom bodies on order for two custom bodybuilders, Labourdette, L-A-B-O-U-R-D-E-T-T-E, and Chaperon, C-H-A-P-R-O-N. Thereafter, I returned to the United States, and I was in the advertising illustration field there in New York. And later on, I went into advertising in Baltimore. I read on, well, first of all, my brother and I invented a sign for a client, an advertising client, which was a beer company. And it was to compete with Neon. It was a Lucite sign. And we went in the sign business, and not being very businesslike, we went bankrupt.
What was the type of sign? Lucite, did you say?
Lucite, yes.
L-U-C-I-T-E. Yeah.
The DuPont product.
Plastic, yeah.
But thereafter, I read an ad in the New York Times which said that there was a large Midwestern corporation looking for an automobile designer with French or Italian experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, with an accent, that that's a me. So I answered the ad, and it turned out that it was General Motors.
What year was this?
This was in 1939, early 39. And I came out to Detroit in 39. I think it was in September, and joined the styling section under Holly Earle.
Who was your first contact there?
My first contact was Howard O'Leary, who was the director of styling at the time.
He was the administrator head?
Administrator head, yes.
Did you, how did you find him? Was he sympathetic?
Oh, he's a die for man, yes. Mm-hmm. And I thought that he would give me a few succinct words how the styling section operated and what I was to do and so forth. Instead of that, he put his feet on the desk and said, "Do you like to go fishing?" And I said, "I sure do." He says, "You'll get along with me fine." But there at first, of course, I was introduced to design at GM by joining studios already in operation with other men who were conversant with automotive design, and in that way I learned the techniques that were used at that time.
Did you learn from Mr. O'Leary or from anyone else subsequently why the wording French and Italian design experience?
Well, the reason for the ad, French and Italian, was that Harley Earle was an exploratory man. He was a curious man. He was reaching out all over the world. He wanted and gathered together, in my opinion, a group of designers who were, without a doubt, the best in the world, and from all over. They were from all over the United States, and the ad that he put in the Times was to get foreign contribution as well.
Mm-hmm.
He himself, of course, had come from Hollywood, and his experience had been in custom bodies for Hollywood stars.
Mm-hmm.
His father had an operation there that he had joined. And the Fisher brothers were the ones who met him there. You probably have heard all this before.
No, please go ahead.
But he then developed what was then known as the styling section. And it was located in the research building, which was behind the General Motors building.
On
Milwaukee.
Milwaukee Avenue.
Yes, mm-hmm. It was an 11-story building.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an auditorium on the 11th floor and the administration offices as well. The Fisher brothers were involved at that time, mainly Larry Fisher and W.A. Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to visit the studios to see what was cooking.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There were many special cars that were done later on after I joined studios myself. There were cars that were done for well-known people. This is a number of years later.
Mm-hmm.
For people like the Duke of Windsor, for Hopalong Cassidy, for the King Ranch in Texas, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And these were cars that one designed and built to not just for the people themselves, but to expand your imagination and to give rein to a large horizon of activity. In other words, to build cars that no one else had done before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this, of course, was an early part of that experience, but leading up to what was later known as the Motorama cars.
Mm-hmm.
And these, of course, were done not for people, but for the corporation itself, and to actually expand the horizons of styling.
But in 36, you were
39.
I'm sorry. You were assigned to a studio. The first thing, or what was your first? What were your first duties?
My first duties there were were interiors.
Interior.
The interior designer for the year before had designed a number of interiors that were impossible to build.
Oh.
And he had just left the area. So I had to do a full line of interiors for GM, and I worked Saturdays, Sundays, nights, and holidays.
I bet you did.
And finally did these full-size interiors on rolling blackboards, which were exhibited on both sides in the auditorium, and approved by W.A. Fisher himself. And that was my first experience with, and it went over well.
Was this for the 40 or the 41?
This was for the, I believe the 40. It must have been the 41, yes.
41.
That's right.
So at that time, W.A. Fisher was very much involved in
yes, he
in
was.
Coach work,
yes.
Interior and exterior.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. When did you first meet Mr. Earle?
Well, shortly after I arrived, yes. He was very active. He visited all the studios, and he was very active in everything. He wasn't a man just as an administrator at all or a critic. He would actually come in and sit down and be involved in all of the operations, exterior, interior.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a Mr. Andrade, A-N-D-R-A-D-E,
mm-hmm.
who was sort of a coordinator for design,
mm-hmm.
as well as being...
His first name?
Julio.
It was Julio.
Julio,
yes.
Andrade, yes.
J-U-L-I-O.
J-U-L-I-O, yes.
Right.
And he, I believe, was an engineer as well.
Mm-hmm. He would function as a...
He was a body layout man,
was
as a matter of fact, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, adept in all the phases of design.
Mm-hmm. He would be sort of a watchdog for Mr. Earle, perhaps.
Yes, he was. He was, I would say that when Mr. Earle wasn't there, he was running the design
mm-hmm.
Area. But Mr. Earle was a super salesman. He not only would sell the divisions on, you know, the design and the cars themselves. You see, when the cars were finished, they had to be presented to each division of General Motors,
mm-hmm.
You know, Buick, Olds, Cadillac,
right.
etc. And he didn't seem to have too much difficulty there, but on occasion, somebody would have a definite opinion and decide that it had to be changed or modified, and
mm-hmm.
in that case we worked over the weekend too.
Mm-hmm. So you had this crisis presented to you almost the moment you arrived, that you had to do the complete interior line or complete interiors for the whole General Motors line.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, that activity was a one continuing crisis after another.
Was it? Why
yes.
was that?
Well, either a new model would be added or dropped, or there was always more work than one could do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We would do the cars, and then along came the tech center. It was originally supposed to be just the styling section.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Earle Harley sold it to Sloan.
Mm-hmm.
Alfred Richard Sloan, who at that time was the chairman,
mm-hmm.
and the power behind the whole of General Motors,
yes.
and his approval was necessary for anything of that nature. And he thought it was such a great idea that he expanded it and included all of the technical and engineering activities as well.
Mm-hmm. But I'm interested specifically in your experience. You came in and you were presented with this rather daunting assignment that you should come up with a complete interior line. What models did you use? Did you draw on your past experience or what had been done at General Motors in the past? Or?
Well, you see, my experience had been automotive somewhat,
right.
To a limited degree, but along with it, fashion, which
right.
included fabrics and
colors,
and then illustration and design.
And you were very familiar with interior coachwork in Europe,
yes.
as well.
And the thing is that all of those sort of came together, and naturally, you had to build on the past too, which
mm-hmm.
was former interiors and
right.
and the hardware and so forth that was available at the time.
Right.
But then you had to marry it with possibility and practicability and cost,
right.
which was a big challenge and a lesson for me at the same time.
So it was a real crucible, really.
It really was, because at that time, too, I only had two assistants to do all of this. And this was five divisions.
Really?
But of course, there weren't as many models as there are now.
You must have said to yourself, what have I got myself into?
I didn't have time to think much about that.
Yeah.
However,
obviously you succeeded. People approved, obviously, of your designs.
Yes, and then, of course, along came the war,
mm-hmm. so it
which
knocked
everything out, and we then worked on war projects for the duration,
mm-hmm.
which is, were interesting, but drudgery as well.
Yeah. Not very exciting.
Well, one of the things had to do with camouflage,
mm-hmm.
which I wrote a book about that.
Did you?
And then we did an instrument flight training manual for the Navy.
Camouflaging is the art of muting colors, is it not?
Yes, and hiding whatever you have to hide. I'll never recall.
Pardon?
I'll never recall.
Wait a minute.
We were inspecting a steel plant, and the chief engineer of the steel plant took us up on top of a huge gas tank, and down below were these coke ovens with open to the sky with the white hot ore, like a searchlight. He says, go ahead, camouflage that. So those were a few of the projects that we did during the war, but we...
The naval flight manual you mentioned, what was that?
Well, it was an actual instrument flight training for Navy pilots.
A whole program
with illustrations of all of the different situations and positions and instruments and aircraft flying.
Mm-hmm.
Then we also started a new thing for the Army, which involved, it was... knock it off, which was called production illustration. What had happened in foreign countries like in Africa, where the Germans were attacking and so forth, there were different arms that had to be assembled there, like aircraft and aircraft cannon and so forth. And you needed to have native labor, and of course they didn't speak English, so you taught them with illustrations, and we would take each element of each arm, like a cannon, and take it all apart, and each screw would have to be illustrated, and this screw goes in that hole, et cetera, until the thing was assembled. This was we not only had some of a few of our designers that were left, but we gathered together a number of wonderful illustrators who joined us, and it became a sort of a huge project that revolutionized that type of operation. It was very successful too.
Who was the person behind this? Was did Harley Earl continue on in this type of work for the company?
Well, there were a few designers that were left to continue our styling section after the war, but we were all involved in war work.
Right.
And Harley Earl, of course, was involved in it too.
The people you worked with in the late 30s, early 40s, like Mitchell and possibly Hershey and others, did they stay on, or were they with the unit? Or
Mitchell was down in Washington with a Navy unit, I forget what the name of it was.
Uh-huh.
And many of them were in the Army or the Navy or various other functions.
Did you, along with your war work, was there any attempt by Earl or others to plan for post-war styling problems during the war or late in the war?
Well, there was some thinking going on, and every designer always likes to keep his hand in, and you keep on sketching, whether it's in your own time or extra time or whatever. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, most of those were done that way.
Right. Yes, the ones you've sketched during the war. So there was thinking not only on the individual designers, but at a corporate level about what
it would be a necessity for it after the war, and probably a greater one than before, because there's a space of time has passed and thinking has changed, and. As a result of that, you need new ideas and new tooling, of course, after the war to get going again.
Whatever vehicles that were produced for the armed forces, the staff cars, the trucks, and so forth, was that done, was any of that design done within your unit, or was that simply using existing models?
That was all using existing models, yes. We actually did some work illustrations mainly for tank destroyers and things of that nature too, aircraft. Mainly there was not too much activity in the automotive design field at all.
In your camouflage unit, was that a working on general principles of camouflage using colors and non-colors?
Colors and materials and methods of camouflage for lots of many different subjects. In other words, factories, railroads, roadways, equipment, personnel, all the phases are necessary. We, of course, thought that perhaps the Germans and the Japs might bomb the United States,
right.
If you recall.
Very real fear. Yeah.
Yes, and so there was a demand for this type of thing, not just from GM or the Army, but from many other companies in the country.
Mm-hmm. Was any of your camouflage theories applied to Army, Navy vehicles, or installations? Or
well, I believe so,
uniforms?
Because the book was published and accepted by them, yes.
Do you have a copy of that, by the way? Sorry.
Yes, I don't know, I have it right
no,
right
I mean,
now. I don't exactly know where it is.
I'd like to see it.
Yes.
This was published by the General Motors Corporation for the War Department.
Yes, it was.
And it was uniformly applied pretty much throughout the armed forces.
Well, I'm not sure of that because I didn't follow that phase of it at all.
Well, then the war is winding down successfully, and people are beginning to think about post-war automobile industry. How did you fit into that?
Well, we just returned to the styling section and took up where we left off.
Mm-hmm.
I recall after the war, the Ford Motor Company had a new body, and Chevy didn't. And there was a big red flares going up in the skies because I knew myself that that was dangerous, and so did they. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I made the suggestion of doing the interiors in four colors in order to supplement it, in other words, instead of.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, that saved their skin.
Really? How did that work out?
Well, the thing is that it was the first time that a low-priced car had four-color interiors. Before that, it was mouse brown and mouse gray. So we changed that to a pearl gray and a beige and a blue and a green. And that was taken to Fisher Body, and the head of Fisher Body said, "Are you nuts? You're going to ruin the whole production line."
That's all I ever thought about, was the production line.
And at that time, Ed Cole was head of Chevrolet.
I was
there. And he said, "Well, if you can't do it, we'll get somebody that can."
Good for him.
But then, of course, began a new phase of design that culminated in Motorama cars, which was really intriguing to designers. But of course, it doubled our work because we had to do the production cars as well as the Motorama cars. And along with the Motorama cars were the Motorama show itself and the whole line of specially designed trucks that were transported the cars from one site to another. That was shown in Boston, New York, Miami, Chicago, San Francisco, and L.A.
So-called dream cars were put together.
Yes.
For that, design concept cars.
And I had to do with many of those.
Can you tell us some of those, about some of those, if you remember?
Well, there were so many, it's difficult. There was a Pontiac, the Club de Mer, there was a Buick Centurion, there was a Cadillac town car. It wasn't called that, but...
Were you involved at all with the first post-war Sabre?
Yes, I was.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? We're intrigued by that car.
Well, the Sabre was a car actually built by Harley Earl and driven by Harley Earl. As a matter of fact, it was named by me, you know, French name. It's
really?
Called
yeah.
Le Sabre, S-A-B-R-E. Yes.
Right. Uh-huh.
And it had many of the features that we had been dreaming of and promoting, compound curved glass, windshield, new type of headlights. It had a brand new type of instrument panel and seating and interior materials. You see, there were many innovations that evolved, not just from the Sabre, but from the Motorama cars that were later used in production. Windshield is one, the dual headlights, rectangular headlights, concealed windshield wipers, a revolving seat, a driver's seat.
Certainly startlingly ahead of their time at that juncture.
Yes, nylon upholstery and carpeting and jacquard upholstery. There was one, I recall, a jacquard, which is an intricate design that's done by machinery. It used to be done by hand. JACQUARD.
What does that refer to?
Well, it's the ability to make non-geometric designs with the machine in fabrics.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular fabric I'm speaking of had the Cadillac emblem repeated in small manner to make a pattern for cloth, seating cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was used for other designs as well, naturally.
Mr. Earl used the original Le Sabre for, is it a personal car, did you say, for some time?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it was used exclusively by him.
By him, uh-huh.
Yes.
And taking you back just a bit, do you recall ever having any input into the Y job, the Buick, the other Buick Y job?
No, that was done before I arrived.
Before you arrived.
Yes.
But the LeSabre, you had quite a bit to do with.
Yes.
Setting up the interiors and the colors and the naming.
Yes.
Do you think that was an influential car on, you mentioned that many of the innovations eventually were adopted. Do you view the LeSabre as a milestone in design concept cars for General Motors?
I think it was, yes. And much more so, for instance, than, you know, some of the Firebirds later.
Which were rather aero and futuristic.
Yes.
If you could give us some last comments on the LeSabre, which apparently was a very influential design concept car, especially in General Motors.
Well, the LeSabre, of course, was a spectacular car in itself, and wherever it went, it was regarded by many as a huge step forward. It's difficult to say what exact influence it had, but it had an enthusiastic influence. In other words, it helped people to think ahead more, to reach for the moon,
mm-hmm.
and settle for the stars.
Mm-hmm. So it gave the individual designers or the collective designers a chance to really open up their horizons.
This really was Harley Earl's effort to get designers to think ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. From then on, everyone was in the mood to reach out. And many of the designers there did. After the war, for instance, I was made head of the Buick studio, and I worked with the other heads of studios, of course, but the main thing was that I worked very closely with Harlow Curtis, who later became president of General Motors, and developed into one of the prime movers in General Motors. As a matter of fact, he was made Man of the Year in 55, which came later. But
Tom, you're speaking of, he's General Manager of the Buick Division.
General Manager of the Buick Division, yes. And he was a terrific salesman. He lifted Buick actually from a lowly position, which it was in when he arrived there, to one of the highest. And perhaps he was even competing with Chevrolet.
Very dynamic fellow.
I remember at a executive meeting in Greenbrier that this was at the time Congress was investigating GM for having more than 50% of the sales, and he opened the whole meeting with all the press there by saying that, I understand, gentlemen, that we have roughly 50% of the sales, and this only means one thing to me, that we're losing out on 50%. And of course, all the press rushed for the phones. But it showed what type of a man he was, and he was very progressive, too. And
so you felt an instant rapport with him?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, he was instrumental in many of the advances that Buick made, the Dynaflow and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And
he was receptive to design decisions that you were making as well.
That's correct. And therefore, thereafter, I was sort of kicked upstairs from the Buick studio, and I was the one who recommended Ned Nichols to replace myself.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a marvelous job of that. And I was then in the administrative end of it,
mm-hmm.
Design-wise.
How'd that work?
Well, I had to do with all of the studios then, and with interiors as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I guess, at that time that we started thinking about the tech center.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said before, that it was sold to Sloan and...
the idea.
Yes, and I actually helped to plan the first layout for the tech center, and I worked with Saarinen and Swanson.
Mm-hmm.
But the first layouts were for the styling section alone, and it didn't develop exactly that way. They never built the tennis courts and the swimming pool or the airport.
Really?
The airport, I think they'd like to have now.
Yes, they certainly would.
But at any rate, that was quite an experience.
Yeah, quarters were becoming a bit cramped on Milwaukee.
They were, yes. They were always cramped, as a matter of fact. We showed the cars on the roof.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it was not a great spot to show them, as a matter of fact, in comparison to the tech center, where now you have that beautiful domed auditorium with a show courtyard behind it.
Was that one of your innovations in the original plans?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And then I had a studio on the roof, which was a circular one with an open air circle in the center with a fountain in it, so that it was very strange in the winter. The snow would be snowing inside the studio or raining inside the studio.
Oh. This is not Milwaukee Avenue.
No, this is out of the Tech Center.
Oh, Tech Center. Oh, yes. I see. Tell me that again. It would be what?
It was a circular studio with a circular open air center inside the studio.
Uh-huh.
With a fountain that went up above the roof.
Uh-huh.
And so when it rained in the studio, and it snowed in the studio. But we had, for instance, a new item which was developed with DuPont, 1,000 shades of colors. There's a spectrum, a color spectrum of paint operated by a motor. You could turn these pylons and get whatever color, shade of color you wanted. And then there was another room.
Was that one of your innovations also?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lighting room which had any kind of lighting that there is, you know, from fluorescent to electric to daylight to moonlight.
Really?
So that you could see what it did to colors under different conditions.
Mm-hmm. Talking about fabrics.
Fabrics or paint,
paint
or,
paint,
or plastics or leather,
anything.
Whatever, yes.
Anything.
That's correct. So,
it's quite unusual, quite forward-looking for its time. Isn't it?
Oh, yes, and that whole styling section there is still, you know, quite advanced.
Yes.
There are many items there that are really fabulous. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact that, you know, we helped select various sculptures and artworks for the whole area.
Mm-hmm.
The stairway, for instance, entering the styling, is an aerial stairway that goes over a pool.
Yes.
To the second floor.
You've
probably been there,
yes,
haven't you?
Yes, yes, and it's still working beautifully.
Yes.
Well, then you were sort of a artistic Howard O'Leary then, at this point. You were,
in a way, yes.
And you were in an administrative position, but you were actually overseeing the design decisions.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, when I left General Motors, I was staff assistant in charge of automotive design.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
so this is in the early 50s you're talking about?
Well, in 56.
I mean the promotion to the administrative.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, all through the 50s, the early 50s you were working at Buick, the Buick studio.
Yes, that's right.
The things like the Riviera and the Roadmaster, were those out of your shop?
Yes, they were.
Can you tell us a bit about those landmark designs?
Well, we did in the Buick studio, we did the first Riviera, which I named also.
You did?
That old French influence again.
Yes.
And the Coupe de Ville.
Right, uh-huh.
The thing is, and the Parisienne, the Pontiac.
You certainly left your mark on those names.
Yes, indeed. And it was all fun, too. The thing is that was the marvelous thing about styling in those particular days.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun. You didn't mind working your head off mm-hmm. because everything you're doing was fun.
Right.
And it was all, and the great reward was to see that come to life, to be finished, to sit there in the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
I did a home show one time with Arlene Francis, you know.
Mm-hmm, I remember that.
Where I took it was a Pontiac convertible, I forget what year that was. But she was saying, now, "Is this the first time you've seen this car?" I said, "No, it's the first time you've seen it."
You've lived with it.
But to stand there, actually it was the first one out.
Was it?
And to stand there and to see something that you had seen being developed, mm-hmm. and there, you know, in its gleaming glory. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens, of course, in a motorama where you've been working your can off forever. Mm-hmm. And to see all of those things gather in this beautiful setting, a theatrical setting, mm-hmm. was fantastic. And those motorama previews, for instance, where all of the well-known people in the town were invited, plus others from out of town or from foreign countries, you know, like the Duke of Windsor would come and mm-hmm. to this wonderful cocktail party. And all of the executives of GM would be there to greet them, of course.
The Motorama idea was certainly a stunning one. It really took automotive design to the people, did it not? And
well, not only that, but you see, what really happened was you got publicity from it that you couldn't buy.
Mm-hmm.
In every town you went, there were all the papers, the New York Times, the Miami Herald, and so forth. They would have special editions for the Motorama.
Right.
And here's this car, and here's that car, and so forth. And at the same time, you're selling cars, or the dealers are.
Right, yeah.
So it was a fantastic, inexpensive thing, really.
Mm-hmm.
What you spent for the Motorama was less than what you could have bought that advertising for.
And they were trucked around the country in large exhibit trucks, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
You would include design concept cars or dream cars, plus some of the newest production cars as well.
Oh yes, and the newest production cars, we would do special cars on production cars too, special interiors and special paint jobs and special names and so
special
forth.
Editions, really.
Special editions. Right. Each division had their own, and that too was a lot of work. But all of those things, you see, like the Motorama, then before that, you know, the Parade of Progress, the Powerama, the Train of Tomorrow, the Scenic Cruiser, these were all Harley Earl's mainly ideas of gaining notoriety or publicity or advantageous position in each field. You know, you take Frigidaire, well, styling designed the refrigerators and the stoves and so forth,
mm-hmm.
but you know, from that came air conditioning and cars. And so that each item that was touched by styling reverberated to the benefit of the company.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever accompany any of the Motorama shows to the major cities?
Yes, I did quite often.
Did you? Mm-hmm.
Yes. I wouldn't stay for the whole show, but I
right.
Might tend to preview, you see.
Right. Mm-hmm.
As would Harley Earl and others from styling.
Division heads and others?
Yes, mm-hmm. division heads would always attend.
Would they?
Yes.
So these were rather gala affairs.
Oh, yes. You know, for instance, the one in Florida, Dinner Key, was a fantastic, was almost a society event.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there again, in the papers, would report after the fact, you know, who was there,
mm-hmm.
pictures of well-known movie stars and industrialists and so forth.
And the New York openings and the Chicago openings were probably well attended also.
Oh yes, all were.
Mm-hmm.
LA,
yeah.
Particularly.
Sounds like fun, but a lot of work.
The fun was short-lived.
As
soon as you got back, you were on the grindstone again. You were a slave.
Yes, I can imagine.
But
that was a remarkable concept, and I think it was envied throughout the industry.
Yes, and I really, there's a little of it going on now, but I just wonder why it was ever dropped.
Yes.
I still think it should be redone.
Oh, yes, marvelous difference. Your career then took a turn from a single studio work to working with all of them, again, with all of the divisions.
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm. And, of course, at that time, you see, Bill Mitchell had been with styling, but he was now running the Harley Earl Corporation, which is a design corporation that Harley had outside of GM.
How is he allowed to do that? That seems a bit...
Well, it does seem a bit. And it was a bit.
How'd that come about?
Well, because of Harley Earl's influence, I guess.
He could push it through, huh?
Yes. And it wasn't until he returned that I thought of leaving.
Uh-huh.
I, as a matter of fact, had a divergence of opinion about the way Starling was going at that time, which was what I called the jukebox era.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
Or the club sandwich era.
That's very distressing to you at that time.
Yes, it was. And so...
How did this evolve from the fairly artistic efforts of the Dream Cars and the Media Post-War Cars, suddenly something happened? Can you pinpoint the...
Well, I guess it was maybe a mentality of, instead of austerity, of gaudiness. It was...
floodgates just opened up.
Yes, and maybe fueled by the public's wish for something that looked like jewelry.
No more wartime austerity.
Yes, that's the only explanation I could have for it, but... I don't think that designers should have given in to that.
Were there others in the industry that were pushing this, maybe like...
Well, they were following GM's lead, I think.
Were they?
Chrysler did, as you know, with the fins and
right.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And Ford did, too, to a certain extent.
Do you feel that there was something Earl perceived that the public was ready for, as you say, gaudiness?
Well, I think that was helped along by Mitchell, too.
Oh, I see. Mitchell came along back
yes.
from back to the company and
yes.
began pushing this, I see, at that level. Well, did he come back to be an assistant to Harley Earl?
Well, he actually came back to take Howard O'Leary's place.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. O'Leary retired in the 50s.
Yes, mm-hmm. And he had, naturally, a lot of influence with Harley Earl.
Right. So at this point,
at that point, I left GM by mutual agreement, taking my bonus with me,
mm-hmm.
but which would prevent me from working for another automotive company for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
which actually happened. I got other accounts, of course.
Was it kind of a wrench, this decision you finally made? What events led up to it?
Well, it was just a divergence of opinion, I believe, and also a desire to do something new and different. You see, I've been doing this now for some time, and I don't know whether you know it or not, but in the automotive design field, you have a recurring thing, which is you do the best car you know how to do now,
mm-hmm.
and you come up to a deadline,
mm-hmm.
and the next day, you have to do the best car you know how to do, but don't change anything. And so you do it with spaghetti.
How's that?
Well, spaghetti is what we call the, hanging on moldings or changing them or changing the front end and
mm-hmm.
the rear, but keeping the same body.
Mm-hmm.
And so that becomes a sort of a chore after a while.
Did you feel your artistic integrity was being compromised by this push toward what someone characterizes the age of warp?
I did, yes.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that helped me make a decision as well.
Did you have some discussions with Mr. Earl about this?
Yes, on many occasions.
What kind of conclusions did you both come to?
The conversation would be chopped off.
Oh, I see. He wasn't interested in that.
No.
This is late in his career when he's really
yes, it is.
Reaching.
I would say so.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I left the corporation and started my own design company, and thereafter...
Where was that located?
Here in Detroit.
And what was the name of the corporation?
Design for Tomorrow.
Design for Tomorrow.
Yeah. And so I got a number of different accounts, Fairbanks Morse, Avis Industries. I designed a house for Warren Avis in Acapulco, which you may
right.
have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
It was in Architectural Digest.
Was it?
But then I also became a consultant designer for Citroën, and I designed three cars that got the Car of the Year award.
What year was that?
Well, the GS, the CX, and the SM.
Mm-hmm.
The SM came out in 72, but of course it was started in about 65.
Mm-hmm. But you left in 56.
I hate to say it, but that's the one that the Sable copied.
Oh, did they?
Yes.
The current Sable?
Yes.
Which one? The Citroën?
SM.
SM.
And then the Opel Omega copied the CX. I mean, verbatim.
Really?
Yes.
Incredible.
And the unfortunate thing for them is that Citroën has a new AX, which is a subcompact that has the same front end.
That what?
That has the same front end as the Opel now.
Oh, no. You had nothing to do with that then?
No.
Well, how did you feel when you left General Motors? Was it kind of a wrench? You've been there for about a decade or so.
Yes, I've been there 17 years.
Yeah, oh, two decades, right?
Yes.
Of course, yeah. Was it quite a wrench leaving the environment?
In a way, but then it was also like a freedom, you know,
right.
A freedom fighter.
Right, yes.
And I was sort of dancing in the meadow.
Oh.
It's a big change, naturally, but a pleasant one.
Mm-hmm.
And
Partying was amicable between you and Mr. Moore.
Oh, sure. More or less, let's say.
Yeah. As much as you could be with him. Right?
That's right. And no, I didn't have so much of a divergence of opinion with him as I did with Bill Mitchell.
I see. Mitchell's rather very strong.
Yes, and I didn't really care for him too much.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't maybe be saying this, but...
But you didn't think much of his design capabilities either.
At the time. Later on, I think he improved, or with the help of other people.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there are other designers there who nobody in that field, much as they claim to, does anything by himself.
That's true.
And that was one of the pleasures of leaving, because then what I was doing by myself.
Doing all your own
yes.
Projects.
So, for instance, the Citroën thing was an absolute delight.
Uh-huh.
I had been warned about Citroën by other people saying, oh, that place, you go in the front door, they throw you out the back.
Really?
But what actually happened was, this will give you an example. I sent them a bill for expenses and travel and so forth, and I got a call from the treasurer's office to come and see him. And I said, oh, well, here comes the old argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in and I said, is this about the bill? And he said, yes, it is. He says, please, no details, just the total. Which is the first time that had ever happened to me. But of course, it makes you even more scrupulous because, you know, what a lovely arrangement. And the other thing is, you see, I would do all my work here, and I would go over there two or three times a year, and they would loan me a car, and I would spend a week or so with them, and then travel around for a month.
Mm-hmm.
So it was absolutely delightful.
Can you give sort of a look at how one starts his own design agency? Obviously, you had made a lot of contacts over the years, working for top-level General Motors job, and you had your own contacts that you developed, plus your European background. How did that work?
Well, the thing is that, you know, when I knew I was going to leave, I contacted some of these people, and
mm-hmm.
They said, well, you know, as soon as you do leave, come and see us, and we'll talk about our getting you our account.
What did you do for Fairbanks Morris?
Many things. Scales, for instance, as you know, that's where they started.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But they make all sorts of products. They make television sets, radio sets, lawnmowers,
mm-hmm.
locomotives, pumps. They made a pump for the Lake Okeechobee. That's such a fantastic pump. It can flood a football field 10 feet deep in 3 minutes.
So you were really jumping into industrial design, pretty much.
Yes. I did a desalting plant for Israel.
Did you?
And made it look the part, you know. A snorkel in the sea at one end and a drinking fountain at the other.
These are exciting times for you. You've traveled all over the world.
Very, yes.
Working on these various commissions.
And then, of course, since then, right now, for the last 12 years, we've been developing what we modestly call the best electric car in the world.
Now, who is this for?
For ourselves. We have our own company.
Oh, your own company?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
It's called the Silver Volt, and I'll show you some pictures of it shortly. We've broken all the records there are for electric cars, and it's not a glorified golf cart, but a deluxe quality automobile that has, all power steering and power brakes and air conditioning and stereo and a luxury interior. It does 75 miles an hour.
What sort of prospects do you have in terms of production?
Well, we are just now reaching the point where we're getting it financed.
Mm-hmm.
What we're going to do now, first of all, is to build a battery plant down in the Bahamas in Freeport. We like the name of the town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have a 20-year tax-free status there. And that will finance the car production, along with some private investors.
Where will your production plant be? Will it be in Freeport or?
Well, we'll do the electronics down there.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to Citroën, that was your first big automotive commission after leaving General Motors.
Effort, yes.
How did that come about? Do you remember the details?
Yes, it was very strange. The president of Citroën came over here to visit Detroit. He doesn't speak any English.
Mm-hmm.
And the French consul called me and told me he was having a cocktail party for the heads of Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors
mm-hmm.
for him.
Mm-hmm.
And would I come and translate for him, which I did.
You'd obviously kept up the...
Yes, I speak French as
yes.
well as English.
Good. Mm-hmm.
And so after it was over, he thanked me very much, and then he asked me what I thought of the Citroën design.
Mm-hmm. This was what year was that?
This was about 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that, it's a very difficult thing to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I said, well, you may have a different concept in France of design than we have here, and you may have seen that reflected in your sales. I knew they weren't selling.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yes, indeed, we have. And do you think you could do anything about it?
This was the radical design that
shocked
everyone.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. the one that looked like a cross between a clam and a vacuum cleaner. So he said, when will you be in France? And I naturally bought a ticket the next day.
Well, did you? Oh, great. Yeah.
So
and that provided the entree to the...
That's
the
how that started, yes.
How did they receive you? What was your reception in France? What experiences did you have there?
It was all very good.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing bad at all.
They were all obviously looking for someone to help them.
Yes, of course. And
did they have their own design department at the time?
Yes, but it wasn't what one would really call a design department. It was mostly design engineers.
Mm-hmm. The old tradition that
yes.
Earl had superseded.
That's correct. It was more modernized than when Earl came,
right.
But still, it was antique as far as design was concerned.
Right.
And what I helped do was really lift them out of the gutter.
Mm-hmm. Right. How did you modify that? Looking back, who had been responsible for that rather startling departure at Citroën? Did you ever find out?
Yes, it was an Italian, as a matter of fact.
Uh-huh.
And,
you remember his name?
I don't recall his name
mm-hmm.
at the present, no.
But he had been imported to spruce up the line and...
Well, he was another design engineer, but he had a... What he did have, you see, was ingenuity,
mm-hmm.
Plus a sense of aerodynamics,
mm-hmm.
because that... of course, is a very aerodynamic car.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the first, I would say.
I think you're right.
And from that standpoint, it was a pretty good performer too, in relation to the power, the lack of power that it had, as was the SM, for instance, or any of those cars.
It was the beginning also of some sophisticated suspension innovations also.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, the SM itself, based on those innovations, innovated some more. And they had a steering system and a braking system that were really extraordinary. The performance of that car for the power it had was fantastic. It did 140 miles an hour as a had a small V6 Maserati engine.
So your influence was to refine that and make it more
well,
palatable to
design or design the whole car, as a matter of fact.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Which resulted in the SM.
Yes.
What did those initials stand for?
Seguir Maserati.
Ah, and that stood for.
Seguir is my middle name.
Oh, I see. It was your. It was yours. And what is the second word?
Maserati.
Which.
It's a the Maserati car company.
Yes.
It's a Maserati engine.
I see, and that's.
In the car.
Yeah. So it designated the engine.
Yes.
Were you able to then pretty much establish yourself as the key or the chief designer of Citroën in that period?
Well, you see, I was never really completely an employee of Citroën.
You were
I was a design cons-